to sing this song for the healing of the world.
Welcome to Spirit in Action. My name is Mark Helpsmeet, and each week we bring you visits and conversations with people doing healing work for this world, hearing what they're doing and what inspires them and supports them in doing it. Welcome to Spirit in Action. Through the suggestion of one of our Northern Spirit Radio board members, Janine Thull, I decided to attend a presentation last week here in Eau Claire by the Blue Zones Project crew, and my eyes were opened. I'll let their Vice President of Business Development, Margaret Brown, spell it out, but what I think I learned about was a thoughtful and brilliant mechanism to help us live longer and better, to help grow a community into well-being and health. It's something that's been done in many communities already, and hopefully soon on my home turf, with the help of Dave Marquardt and his new organization, TrueWellness.org. But I must note that will only happen with many local minds and hands joining in the process, so I hope you'll all, wherever you are, but particularly here in Eau Claire, Wisconsin, learn about Blue Zones and be part of using their powerful insights and tools to revolutionize our community intelligence for the good of all. Many thanks to Andrew Jansen for production assistance on today's program. Margaret Brown now joins us via Zoom from Camden, South Carolina. Margaret, it's good to see you again so soon, now for Spirit in Action.
Absolutely. It's been a great pleasure working with everyone in Wisconsin, and I'm happy to be here today to share a little more.
And I got to see you just about a week ago here in Eau Claire. Where else did you go before and after that?
So we were first in Eau Claire last week, and then we were up at Rice Lake in Menominee last week.
How did you come to get focused here?
You have a remarkable, passionate leader in the area, Dave Marquardt. He primarily has car dealerships, but he started tiptoeing into the space of health and wellness and founded True Wellness, which is a nonprofit organization based there in Eau Claire, and reached out to Blue Zones because he wanted to bring a proven model to help optimize the environment for health and well-being, primarily because he saw your area businesses were paying simply too much for healthcare to cover their employees. And in some cases, they could not access health insurance at all. So with that, he wanted to improve health and well-being. But when he started looking at Chippewa Falls and Eau Claire, realized he couldn't stop there and really wanted to encapsulate as much of Northwest Wisconsin as he could. And so he picked a couple of anchor communities that have a little bit larger population centers and asked us to, during our assessment period, include those small towns in with Eau Claire and Chippewa Falls. You know, that's truly where we got started. That's the reasoning behind it. And Dave, if you had wanted to get more insight, could probably tell you more. But primarily it's because this kind of covers the Northwest Wisconsin area and gives you a good swath of territory.
You do this, I mean, you were invited to do this here, but you've done it in a number of different areas, right?
Yes. As a matter of fact, this preliminary, what we call readiness and feasibility study, I mean, we have been in several hundred communities just to do the assessment, write up reports. We are sharing our insights and observations of what's making things work in your favor in terms of health and well-being, and maybe where are the challenges. And so we do that as part of our team. We write a report and we deliver that. Of those several hundred that we've done, probably about 95 communities have opted to move forward to what we call transformation. And that's where Blue Zones is supporting a multi-year program to work with city government, work with large stakeholder partners like your health systems, your health plans, your nonprofit organizations, schools, and other stakeholders that fall in those categories to begin changing the systems that are in the environment around you. So we work in policy, people engagement, and also the place-based initiative. So where people go to work, school, where you buy your groceries, and where you may be dining out. So those are some of the areas that we work to help bring healthier options into those areas.
So I'm launching in, Margaret, too quickly into the following points that we need. Let's talk about Blue Zones, first of all. I understand there is some discussion that Blue Zones aren't exactly statistically valid or something like that. So I understand there's some issues about that. But there's no question, but on the earth, there are some places where living is better, longevity is better, and that's part of Blue Zones. So explain the concept to our listeners for Spirit in Action.
So the concept of Blue Zones is really simple. If you consider for a moment, it's been well documented that where we live, the zip code, sometimes a census tract, the neighborhood that we live in shapes our long-term health, our long-term life expectancy in ways that are good. Sometimes they shape our environment shapes it so that we live extra long life. And sometimes our environment is such that we don't live as long a life. Maybe we struggle more with chronic disease and a burden of poverty or other factors that are a direct result of our environment. For Dan Buettner Sr. in the National Geographic team, they were really leaning into this concept of zip code effect. If where you live has the power to dictate your life expectancy, where in the world are people living extra long lives as a result of their environment? And so they went to work looking through the available data from countries around the world, from cities and towns around the world that show overall life expectancy, where people were living past age 95, well into their early 100s at a much higher rate than we do here in the US. And not just living longer, but with a fraction of chronic disease burden that we experience here in the US. And with the data that they had available to them, they found five places in the world that were demographically confirmed, geographically confirmed sites where people were living exceptional long lives. And these were people that were making it into their early 100s and still riding horses, for example, active cowboys, gardening, fishing, swimming, you know, all of the active things that you would expect a much younger person to be doing, you saw with people that were in their late 90s, early 100s. And so from that, you know, looking at those environments and saying, okay, well, what are the things that are going on in that environment? And how is it that this environment is producing healthy lives, long lives? And what they found are what we call the Power Nine, nine common elements that all of these blue zones, hot spots had in common. And it's not anything that anyone can find an argument with. It is as valid as anything that you would find in public health, medical health research background. Demographers have confirmed it. And it's things like moving naturally. We all know that moving more in your day is much healthier for anyone. Having a sedentary lifestyle is like smoking a pack of cigarettes a day. Moving is actually very helpful to anyone that can do so. Other factors, downshifting. We call that downshifting because what you're doing is every day taking a moment to downshift and de-stress. Taking a moment to step away from that job that might be stressing you and maybe take a 5 or 10 minute walk. Maybe prayer is your thing or meditation. These are practices that can help de-stress and can be done every day to help manage that stress. Taking a nap, eating with your family, playing with your grandchildren. Those are de-stressors that should be in regular abundance in your life. The other side of that is also purpose. I think everyone is familiar with someone in your family that may have lived an extra long life, and you would ask them, what kept them going? I can tell you for my father, who's in his 80s and still an active rancher, it's getting up every day and going out and feeding the horses and being involved and greeting the visitors that come on his ranch. That is what makes him every day. He's so excited for that. So, what is it in people's lives and the purpose that they have? That's another component of the Power Nine. Food is a very important aspect. Eat wisely is what we call it. And it's not vegan or vegetarianism. It's simply adding more fruits and vegetables, whole grains, nuts to your plate every day. Beans. These are things that are known for as long as humans have been around to be healthy and part of your diet. We emphasize that not because, again, we're preaching veganism or vegetarianism, but because in America, the common everyday American is more likely to have a large size of protein and no fruit, vegetable, plant on their plate at all. And that is concerning. So, how do we optimize environments to bring more of those healthy choices directly into where people live and can have access to that kind of food? Connection. How people are connected in their communities is a really big component of the Power Nine, and it makes up three of those Power Nine. And that includes being connected to your community, whether that's your faith-based, where you go to church, it's your neighborhood, it's your city, what you consider your community and how closely tied to them you are and how active and participating in your community you are breaks down social isolation, gives you a sense of pride, something that you can give back to. And similarly, being close to your loved ones. Breaking down those barriers to being close to your loved ones. In the original blue zones, they tended to have intergenerational families. Here in the US, that's less so the case. We tend to be spread out. But how do you take care of those close to you and really keep them close, look after them, make time to care for them. That's an important component. And then finally, on the connection front, keeping your close friends, having someone you can go to on a bad day, having someone you can go to on a good day. In the original Blue Zones, they often had friendships that lasted their entire lifetime. We saw many examples of friendships that had spanned 90 plus years in small communities. And so, how do we maintain those friendships in today's world? Take them offline, meaning not just on social media where we're liking a picture or responding to a post, but truly interacting person to person, conversations, keeping those friendships active are an important part of what we believe in the Power Nine. So I think when you look at those are common sense elements. They're things that everyone talks about one way or another. They're typically things that healthcare entities, public health, nonprofit organizations are seeking to infuse in communities. A lot of city municipal planning has these elements built in that they're trying to proactively establish in communities, and Blue Zones is an excellent partner along the way to help bring these component pieces into where people live and go about their day every day in a community.
I think you're saying two things. Number one, that in the studies of the blue areas, you note these commonalities. And on the other side, you've experimented with it in the physical placement, if we change these elements. So how long has your experiment been going on?
Our first community launched in 2009. Planning began for that in 2008, and that was in Albert Lea, Minnesota. So, what is that now? Almost 18 years we've been at this work, and the work has proven again and again to have a tremendous outcome for these communities. If you look at Albert Lea, a community that prior to partnering with Blue Zones was really looking at, just being another town with a four-lane highway passing right through the middle of it. No sense of community, kind of just keep on going, nothing to see here type of approach. Since Blue Zones has been involved with them, they actually have narrowed their downtown, created a place where people want to stop, shop. The economic corridor there through the downtown of Albert Lea has been bustling and exponentially growing since we began our partnership. The activity within the community, just more people on the street, walking, being actively engaged, has gone up because of the built environment that we helped them design and create. Their work sites, their city government, out of the gate, first few years, reported a 49% decrease in medical claims cost. And this is something that the city has maintained and been able to continue to build on in partnership with other employers. And just another note, now today, from where Albert Lea started, Albert Lea was voted one of the top 50 American small towns to live in, especially for young families. During the pandemic, they increased their residency quite substantially, and their tourism has jumped by over 40% since they began. So it has garnered a lot of attention. So that was our first one. But we've now repeated this more than 90 times, and the outcomes are similar, and some, continue to build on, and we're evolving in what we're learning as we partner with communities. Not every community is the same, so we keep building on that knowledge base and creating new ways of partnering with cities and towns that yield benefit in today's day.
And so that's the first place. How many places are you working with currently? Is this up to the 90 some you were mentioning?
Yep, the 90 something for what we call a Blue Zone certified community, yes.
You get certified right away or afterwards? How long does it
No,
take to
you don't.
become an adult?
You've got to put the work in. There's a lot of metrics that have to be met. This is not an overnight thing. So, for example, when we're working towards certification, you have to meet some really important pillars. You have to demonstrate a change in your selected metrics. Those selected metrics are decided on by the city, the towns, the people that live there, in a format of what we call a steering committee. And they're often looking at things like reducing the incidence of obesity, increasing maybe it's tourism, decreasing things like pedestrian deaths. There's literally hundreds of metrics that a community can choose from when they're going through this process. In addition to that, they have to select metrics from what we call the well-being index. This is a Gallup survey that we utilize. It's a third party. There's a number of metrics that cities will select from that body of metrics. And then finally, there's some process metrics that have to be met. And there are things like, let me back up, there are metrics that have to be passed that are what we consider tipping point metrics. We recognize them as such because we know that once you meet the minimum threshold in these process metrics, that's when you begin to see community-wide change. So things like in the built environment, when we talk about roadways, walkways, transportation, et cetera, In that body of work, for example, just in the built environment, we have 9 total policies that must be implemented in order to demonstrate a tipping point of change in the community that will have a lifetime impact. Same thing in the food environment. Same thing when we talk about schools. 50% of schools have to partner to become what we call Blue Zones approved, which is helping them bring healthy choices inside the school building. That's the minimum threshold. 25% of your total workforce, 15% of a total community engagement actively participating. And there are more, but that's some sampling of like the process metrics that have to be met. So baseline metrics have to improve for outcomes, and your process metrics have to improve. And it typically takes about 4 to 5 years to start to get to that completion where you can recognize a community as certified.
And so we're roughly, I guess, now 18 years or so into your process of bluezones.com. Is that what you're called, just Blue Zones, or is there a better name for you?
Yeah, Blue Zones Project. Blue Zones Project is what we call the work that we do actively with communities today. The Blue Zones references those original Blue Zones communities, but Blue Zones projects are the active work and partnership we do with communities today.
You, Margaret Brown, how long have you been with Blue Zones?
8 years.
I don't see a gold star or anything on your outfit. So, how do people advance in this? How big of an organization are you?
We're still a relatively small organization. We have about 200 employees, but we work across the entire country. So, for the reach that we have a relatively small organization. Myself and several of colleagues that I have, we've actually been with the group for some 10, 15 years. Some have been around since the original Albert Lea launched project and have continued on. I think what you would find with Blue Zones employees, we're extremely passionate and purpose-driven people. Many of us have a background like myself in healthcare, and I've worked with both insurance providers within healthcare entities. I've worked within medical universities. What we have all kind of collectively at one point or another agreed on is the frustration of being within a healthcare entity and just putting a band-aid on things and knowing that prevention is really where it's at. And when you go to school and you have a passion for prevention, and you find something like Blue Zones, it becomes your own purpose. I mean, it really is. And, I would take that further to say my own personal why is I come from a community where my family, moreover, probably 90% of my entire family struggle with diabetes, struggle with things like depression, struggle with other things that limit their mobility. They come from a part of the country that has very limited access to fresh fruits, vegetables, whole grains. Their diet is the predominant cause for some of these issues. I see it as a personal, why that is guiding me every day is, this is an injustice that we've brought to the American people. This is an injustice that has been laid at the doorstep of those that oftentimes have the least. And if we can do something to address the systems that improve these outcomes, what you're going to have is that people can simply live longer, healthier lives, be closer to their family, be productive, have time with their grandchildren, have time with their families. It's not just about being productive on your job, but it's truly about being here to be a part of what makes us all happy. And for me, that's my personal why. And if I can help other communities do that, I definitely want to be there.
You're located in the U.S., and I get the sense. I mean, I know Blue Zones were identified were across the world, so it wasn't just a U.S. thing. But is Blue Zones Project a U.S.-based thing only?
It is today. I would say we have quite a bit of interest. We've heard from countries as far away as Australia and New Zealand, all the way into the Far East and Middle East, and all across Europe, and wanting to partner with Blue Zones. Today, we have primarily worked in the United States. And part of that is because we still have a small team. We would have to expand quite dramatically in order to reach and support the work that's happening in other countries. The other side of it is, our expertise is based in a US system. We understand US healthcare. We understand US policies, generally how things in government works here. In order to expand, we would really have to recruit a team that has that understanding across the globe. Not to say we won't do that in the future, but right now we've been pretty much focused on the US.
I don't want to advocate too strongly, but I just want to put in your ear that I happen to be fluent in French and I've lived in Africa. So if you need staff over there, I might be helpful.
Well, that's great.
And I'll mention one more thing. I've been a vegetarian since 1976. So
Amazing.
maybe that'll help those little pieces.
Yes, that's incredible.
Actually, I'm thinking your staff numbers of around 200. That's minuscule considering the task. You're actually helping to reshape portions of America, so almost 100 of them, with a staff of only 200. So I know from what I heard last week when you presented here that it's a partnership with local folks. I'm thinking that Eau Claire is way ahead of most because we have this strong partnership through the True Wellness and Dave Marquardt. Is that unusual to have that strong of a start?
I would say not unusual, but it certainly helps. We do in many communities, back up and ask, why would communities want to do this? We don't reach out to the communities. I didn't reach out to Dave or True Wellness. He reached out to us, and that's the primary way that people come to us. They've already identified that they want to make a substantial change in their community. They've already identified the people within their community that can partner and help make this happen. And you're exactly right. We have a small staff. And it's the communities that take this work on predominantly themselves, right? So if you have a community like Eau Claire and you've got an organization like True Wellness, Blue Zones is not going to come in and do the work for them. We are going to coach them. We're going to provide them the expertise, the consulting that needs to happen, and work with them along the way. But they actually have to do the work. We can't make change in a community without a community who's willing to roll up their sleeves and get in and bring out the shovels and getting their hands dirty, so to speak. They have to be willing to do it themselves. And we support them along the way. If we were doing it for you, we would have a team of probably 1,000. But we have a small team because we know what it takes to coach and help someone reach their goals. And therefore, we can do it in a very efficient way.
I realized that I couldn't probably be on your staff because I'm overweight. Do people get kicked off of staff by being obese or
Oh,
something?
absolutely not. No, absolutely not. We've had people with all kinds of backgrounds and capabilities and size and everything else. We have a very diverse team. We are not judging people when they come in, just like we don't judge communities when we start working with them. That's just how we are. And we also know that weight is does not equal health. Weight is, sometimes that's a metric that communities look at, but we're not out here saying we're going to help the world lose weight. What we want to focus on is how do we bring more of the Power Nine into where people live every day? There's going to be people that have disabilities that don't allow them to move naturally, right? They're not going to be able to get out and walk. But can they connect with friends? Can they be less socially isolated? Can we help optimize food and bring them healthier foods? But that doesn't mean that someone's going to lose weight overnight, and we treat our teams the same way. That's not the goal. The goal is focusing on the Power Nine and building longevity that way.
As you were listing the nine facets, I guess, maybe the Power Nine, I was aware that you did not mention crime or war or violence in neighborhood. I mean, you have a school shooting and there go all your stats, right? Your average life just sunk by a couple of years. So does that play a part in it? And does that maybe determine whether you're willing to work with an area, a place that's in the mid, going to Ukraine right now might be a kind of a lost cause?
Yeah, of course. But again, we have worked in communities that are struggling. We worked in a community out in California that at one time was the youth gang capital of the world. I mean, youth gang murders were higher than they were anywhere else. Just young people, less than 18, regularly dying because of gang violence. I'm not going to sit here and say Blue Zones turned that around, but what we do know is when you can work through schools and agencies that are focused on those particular types of interventions, you can start to change the conversation and you can start to reduce some of that violence, et cetera. When you talk about suicide, high acuity of mental health, what you want to focus on is how do we help people feel less isolated, get off of their phones, less engaged with whatever's popping up on their screens, and more engaged directly with real people every day. You can start to change the numbers or the sheer percentages of people that are going to experience a really high acuity mental illness. So we're not focused on violence per se, but we're focused on those factors in and around communities that can help mitigate violence. And that's where we tend to go to work. But we're not sitting here saying we can change that for sure. But every community, we have to recognize what their starting point is and create strategies to help them mitigate that. And we work with all kinds of organizations that work in those spaces.
Well, Margaret, here comes one of those questions you may hate. It's what kind of organizations, community, or individuals hate the work that Blue Zones Project brings in. I think that challenges perhaps the interests of some quarters of our country.
Yeah, I would say Blue Zones truly is politically agnostic. We've worked with very red states, very red communities. We've worked with very blue communities. When people voice opposition to what Blue Zones is doing, it's typically because they don't really understand. You know, I've had some people associate us with being focused on a more liberal agenda because our name is Blue Zones. It has nothing to do with going out here and evangelizing a Democratic platform, for example. But there have been a couple of communities, and this always happens when you're partnering with elected leadership on a city level, for example, you have a mayor, city council, and especially in the day and time that we are now, sometimes it's not that they're against Blue Zones. They're against the people who are speaking up to do this kind of change in the community. It has nothing to do with us. It has more to do with you're my opponent, and because you like it, I therefore don't like it. We have had some that have a misunderstanding that Blue Zones is coming in with a mandatory program that says you have to do this and you have to do that. Well, Blue Zones is not saying you have to do anything. There's someone in your community that's elected to partner with us, and we're going to help bring optionality. There is no mandate for anything. But if your kids are going to school and you are a parent, you might be behind having healthier choices on a menu for your kids and maybe them learning about gardening and where your food comes from. And if you, as a parent, you say, no, I hate that because you're trying to mandate something, that's your right. But in fact, we're not. We're just simply trying to revert back to where things used to be when you had more homemade meals at school versus something out of a can. And believe it or not, we have had some school board members and we've had some members of families that have said, absolutely not. I don't want this being pushed on my kid. And it's again, because they don't understand that it's not that we're taking away the option to have chicken nuggets, for example, but it's that we're bringing an option to have something healthier to the table. And if you still want the chicken nuggets, by all means, have the chicken nuggets. But we're not forcing anything on anyone.
Folks, we're speaking today with Margaret Brown. She is Vice President, Business Development for an organization called the Blue Zones Project, their website, bluezones.com. And by the way, I was curious because you are a .com, not a .org. Tell me why that is.
Well, we are a for-profit LLC. We are not a nonprofit. And there's some very good reasons for that. We have an innovation and iterative process. We have investors into our work, and communities partner with us just like they would any consulting group. And so, you know, that's what we are. We partner with a lot of cities and towns, but our model has worked. It has given us the freedom to do things differently, to scale, unlike nonprofits who might be more dependent on fundraising and, you know, more of a foundation kind of mindset, a scarcity mindset, I would say, versus us being able to really scale the work and do work across the country without having some of those limitations.
The reason that came to my attention was because Dave Marquardt, who is founder of True Wellness, with the website truewellness.org, specifically talked about founding a 501c3. And the fact that you weren't struck me as different. And I'm very keyed in on economics. You mentioned, for instance, with Albert Lee, that tourism increased. I'm going, is that a good thing or a bad thing for community health? I don't know. I am sure economically it can help pull some people out of poverty, which can be very helpful. So I'm aware that the number of factors going into any decision are multitudinous.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, in some places, I will say even, you know, we did this process with Sevier County, which is where Gatlinburg is. We also did this with the Outer Banks up in North Carolina. And you would look at these places and say, they absolutely do not need more tourism. You cannot drive a car in these communities when they're in their on season, right? Summer, spring, fall. But actually, what they would like to do is change some of the tourism industry to focus more on health and well-being and to focus more on what they call the shoulder season, times when people are not coming there. That's such a key part of their economy that what they want to do is bring people in that might want to get on the trails and do biking in the off season. They may want to come there and eat healthy food in their restaurants. They may want to tour gardens and farms that are in the area and do workshops around that. So it's a little bit of a different tourism, but it's a good fit for them. And it helps them maintain equilibrium so that people year round have jobs that live there. It continues to drive the economy year round versus just in spikes. The other thing is, for a small town like Albert Lea, who was on the verge literally of almost bankruptcy, creating a place where you would just pass by as quickly as possible, what tourism has done is enabled that community to breed entrepreneurism, open up small shops, community-owned spaces. And you're right, there's some benefit to that. Maybe in some spaces they would not want that. But in small towns, there can be a real benefit to people coming there because it helps drive your local economy, it supports local businesses, brings in tax revenue that supports your schools and build out your roads. There's all kinds of ways in which cities and towns benefit. And I think you want to manage it. You don't want it to get too overburdensome. Tourism can be a burden at times, but with the right balance, it can be a real boost to local economies, especially for small towns.
I do like the values that come in through the points you've already laid out for blue zones. I suspect greatly the kind of policies that come out of just studying GNP or GDP, because you can have a GDP which is going up. Wow, we're getting great production economically, and your life expectancy is plummeting. Those can happen together. Or maybe your GDP is going up because you've got more and more cancer, and therefore people have to spend all their money in hospitals or whatever. So I'm very aware that economics does not equal well-being in some easy formula.
That's right. And I would say too, there's a balance there, right? When you have communities or even neighborhoods, and I hate to use the word failed or are in a failing, progressively are failing, typically what that means is the city or the town is spending more city dollars, tax revenue on things like mitigating violence or mitigating areas that feel not safe in the community. And when that tipping point happens where you're spending more dollars on that than you are investing in your community to make it a place where people want to stay, well, the people that picked your community and moved there, because maybe it's an ideal small town, or maybe it was a perfect place for them to raise a family. And as soon as you can't continue investing in those things that have made that the ideal community, and you start investing more on mitigating violence and failing infrastructure, what happens is the people that moved there initially say, you know what, I think I'm going to move out and go to the next small town or move away because I can find a better quality of life somewhere else. And then what you're left with is the people who can't escape, right? They're there, the failing breeds and continues and perpetuates. And so when you just look at the total balance of how you maintain a community that's thriving, you want to be able to keep both sides of that equation in check. You want to continue doing the things to keep your community safe and those incidents as low as possible, and you want to have as much tax revenue to invest in keeping the community a vibrant place. And that may mean more people want to move there, and maybe the people hate that, but the alternative is often not what you want.
We're going to get more information from Margaret Brown of Blue Zones Project. But first, I want to remind you folks, you are listening to Spirit in Action. We've been on the air now for 20 plus years. So, in other words, I'm saying that we're older and wiser than Blue Zones, which has only been operating since a year or two less than that. But in fact, they've gathered wonderful information from all around the world. And I'll have a link to bluezones.com on my website, northernspiritradio.org. On my site, you find links to my guests of all these past 20 plus years for both my Spirit in Action and my Song of the Soul project. And by the way, our purpose for Northern Spirit Radio, you see it first when you come to our website. Northern Spirit Radio promotes world healing by broadcasting inspirational and educational voices of peace and social justice using language of personal story, music, and spirituality. And I sense some commonality with the work of Blue Zones in this, and which is why I've invited folks here again. Come to our website, check out the links to all of our guests. We've got all the programs going way back, and our programs tend to be evergreen, which is to say they're not just the news of the moment. They're a long-term view, which is I appreciate also about the work of Blue Zones. On our site, please post comments, give us your feedback, help direct us. We are funded by donations of our listeners, not because of government or because of corporations, which means that we listen to you perhaps better because we need to listen to you to lift forward, to lift up this country. So please check it out on northernspiritradio.org. Also, you find the 38 or so stations across the country that carry our shows. So help support them as well. But right now, we're going back to Margaret Brown. Again, she's in Camden, Clinton, South Carolina. That's where she's operating from. But I got to see her right here in Eau Claire, Wisconsin, just last week. I think there's some more reasons people might hate you. And you mentioned chicken nuggets was one of them. You were very careful to make sure that you're not saying that people should be vegetarian or vegan. That's not where you're pointing at. What about you personally?
I would say for me personally, I have some diet restrictions due to food allergies. So I don't eat dairy, but that's because I would have swollen eyes and a swollen throat. I might be in the hospital if I ate dairy. Gluten also is a no-no for me. Just that's my own thing. I mean, that's what I have going on. But I ate hot dog last night. I mean, I think it's about balance. And again, in my own household, we probably eat meat twice a week. But that's just because we're on a different journey. Others that work at Blue Zones do consume animal protein of some sorts of others, but it's about balance. All of us can agree you've got to have more of the things that grow from the earth. Our bodies need that to have a nutrient balance in our bodies. And I don't think there's much argument with that.
Does the omnivore's dilemma at all inform the work that is connected with Blue Zones, or is that even known? In the course of that book, he talks about the different ways people eat, you know, including, you know, we have factory farming and we have people growing from local foods, and he talks about foraging. He talks about the wide diversity of ways we deal with food in the U.S. And in one of his following books, he has the advice, the criteria for eating. It says, eat food, mostly plants, not too much. That's the balance you're talking about.
Yeah, that's right. You know, we're not here preaching a diet. We're not about a diet. A diet is going to fail. We're talking about optimizing environments so people have access to what they need. And I think if you look across a lot of communities, sure, you or I may be able to walk in a grocery store and load up on any number of healthy things, but not everybody can. And not everybody at every social economic status is going to have access to the same things. Sure, you can have farmers markets. Are they only open on Saturday for 4 hours? Are they on a Monday night when a lot of people are working? Is that the only way to get locally produced, locally grown, the healthier options that you can get in your community? Well, that may cut out a large segment of your population. So when we're talking about adding more healthy foods to your diet, the way we do that through the work of Blue Zones is not going out there and saying, okay, guys, you got to be on a diet. You should do this. No, it's optimizing the environment and what people have access to. So oftentimes what we're looking at is how can we look at the food system and all the growers, producers that are in a local region in and around the community that we're working with and create a marketplace by which those local producers, growers have the ability to sell their product, sustain their business, and by the way, that product becomes available to the people who may be on food stamps or the people who don't even qualify for food stamps for any number of reasons that they may not, but they're on a fixed income and they can't afford it. So how do we make these things available to them in and around where they live? So corner markets, grocery stores, food hubs. We work a lot with food policy councils. I think in most communities, there's already an existing food infrastructure group, council, body of people coming together looking to bring those healthier options in abundance in and around where people live. And more often than not, they're focused on the people who don't have. How can we work with the food banks to optimize the nutritional value of the foods that are being offered through the food distribution systems? How do we work with churches to optimize and create more nutrition when they are having events and giving away or feeding individuals who may be homeless or lack the ability to get their own food? Those are the ways in which we do it. It's less so about standing there and saying, shame on you for not eating this way. It's more about, let us help you have access to what we know is a great nutritional value to you and your family. And what we have found is when those things are accessible, people normally choose that. There's a lot of people who don't want to eat, you know, hamburger helper from the food bank. If they had a healthy home-cooked meal, they would choose that over the other option. And that's not me being critical. It's just the state of where we are in the world today. And there's a lot of food banks that are trying to do that on their own, but they come across all kinds of roadblocks and partnering with their local farmers. Primarily, the farmers can't give away their product for free, and food banks often don't have enough money to purchase those things. And so we've got to work in those systems to make it accessible so that everyone can benefit.
I'm wondering if you are introducing heresy into Wisconsin. If I mention which state is connected with cheeseheads, I think you know it'll be Wisconsin, right? And I'm not sure if that's on the good or the evil category or discourage, encourage. And when I'm talking about people hating Blue Zones Project, it's like, are you encouraging something against my beloved, whatever it is, the bacon that we have here or the, you know what I'm saying? Each place has its local fetish, I think.
Of course. Yeah, we've worked with dairy farmers across Pennsylvania. We've worked with folks in the beef industry down in Texas. Again, we're not saying don't eat that. We're also putting an emphasis on those local producers for sure. Where you have local producers of cheese, I bet it's the best cheese you can get anywhere. I bet it's better than what you can buy Cabot Farms. I'm not picking on them, but that's where I used to live in Vermont. It's probably even better than that. And I didn't think there could be anything better than that. But the bottom line is everything needs balance, right? You want to enjoy the foods that you like, but you've got to do so in a balanced way. And so even down in Fort Worth, we worked with steakhouses, not to say we're not serving steak, but can we bring in a salad bar to go along with that steak and not just have it be French fries? Can we offer half portions for people who don't want the 14-ounce sirloin? Maybe they want just a 6-ounce sirloin or 7-ounce sirloin. We got to have a balance. And so we actually want to work with those local producers. So in and around Wisconsin, I can't wait to hear what the folks come back on the food. We have a food policy expert team that's going to actually be meeting with some of those folks. Where are the dairy producers in your area and what kind of products are they producing? And are there any that I can eat that maybe are goat cheese or sheep cheese based? That's what I'm excited about. And so we want to celebrate that and we want to find ways to make that local produced option more readily available to the people who live there. And of course, doing so in a balanced way. It's going to be our motto.
Give me a little bit more insight. I heard some things last week that were very enlightening to me. And one of them, which was, it's like which way you construct sidewalks so that kids can walk to school or so they can walk safely out in the world, right? I've not thought of that before as a community well-being thing, although I should have because there's one of the suburbs that's part of the greater metropolitan area in Milwaukee where they designed all of the streets with walkability in mind. And I know here in Eau Claire, our newly elected president of the city council, Jeremy Gregert, has been a big advocate for bike paths and providing that on our city streets too, so it's safe to bike. So those kind of policies translate into the kind of well-being you're talking about. So could you give me some more idea of the specific ways in which you help communities, you advocate for communities to structure things for the well-being of the community?
So first of all, it starts with the community. And when we're launching a project, we convene in what we call summits. So you'll have a policy summit that's focused on food systems, built environment. You'll have a people summit that's focused on engagement and ensuring that we can bring programs to engage people more socially. And you'll have place-based summits, like a school summit where we're launching into partnering with schools around those environments. But just to back up to the example that you gave around built environment, we can't say to a city, your strategic priority should be safe routes to school. First of all, they have to choose that. They have to select of the things that they're going to work on in the built environment, what are the things that they want to focus on? They may focus on adding more bike paths, just as you said, more biking lanes. They may choose to connect their trails. They may choose a safe routes to school or what is called a Vision Zero plan for their city. But for this sake, let's just say that the community votes and selects that they're going to focus on safe routes to school. The first thing that we have to do is we have to establish a group in and around that that's going to focus on safe routes to school. Which schools are we focusing on? All schools in the city? Are there certain schools that are higher priority? Let's make that selection. Again, the community is going to dictate that. And then we have to assess the area. Typically, you want to start with a demonstration. What does safe routes to school look like? So that the parents, teachers, school administrators can, in their mind, picture what safe routes to school means. Like, are we going to put up a temporary demonstration site where we have kids walking and biking to school every morning? Maybe teachers and staff walking. If you have a school that's out in the rural areas, meaning it's not embedded in a neighborhood or in the city itself, you may have to do what's called a drop to walk type program where you're optimizing the environment in around that rural school so that parents can drive up and drop their kid and they still get that physical activity. It's kind of revamping the drop off cycle there. But all of that has to be designed with the policy team, with the city administrators, with the school administrators. And after you have that demonstration project, typically we say, okay, everyone's voted for this. They like it. We're going to now go write a grant for implementation. And the reason for that is oftentimes those implementations can cost, in the million plus dollar range. And then you would go get the grant and then you're set up to implement it. That's how we begin doing that. But it has to be with community buy-in, parent buy-in, school administration buy-in. And we're kind of helping them along the way to support that design with the community, design and engage with the community to come out the other end with something that everyone appreciates and is suitable, is what they want.
I assume you have to address environmental well-being as well. People who are getting forever chemicals out of the water, they have an issue. Or if people have air pollution that's causing shortened longevity, those things get really political and economic issues become that. Is that the kind of thing that you help communities work on?
We're less so on that side of it directly. I'm going to say we do, that is not where we directly look at cleanup of environmental elements. However, a lot of our work has that as an outcome. So, for example, if you are working in an area to promote more biking, walking, developing of trails, sometimes along with that, you have some environmental cleanup that has to happen. And has to be embedded as part of that work. It's not the direct objective of our work, but it's a byproduct of the work that we're doing that has to happen as a result of the plan that we're looking to implement.
I think more than most community development projects that I've heard about, you mentioned faith and community in a more specific way. I happen to be Quaker, and I naturally am part of that. The Quaker community I'm part of here in Eau Claire, amongst other things, we take care of some of the trails. So on Earth Day, of course, we're out helping clean up that way, but not just that, but several times a year. There's many ways in which community is manifested. I think labor unions actually should be qualified as a faith community of sorts, but there's so many ways that when we have community and we have that support and we have that knitting together of family, friends, and institutions around us, we're so much stronger. What part does faith, religion, other forms of that kind of manifestation, what part do they play in your plans?
Well, it's a very important part. I mean, there is a lot of data research that shows that people who are connected to a faith-based, less important is the type of faith that they're. We're not here to say you should be this kind of Christian or Islam or Jewish. That's not what we're about. If you are connected to a faith-based organization or regular practice, you're much more likely to have a strong sense of purpose. You're much more likely to be connected to like-minded individuals in a community sense, taking care of one another, taking care of your community in the way that you described. And there's good data to say, if you attend church, and especially for women who attend church regularly, I believe that it was something like 40% less chance of suicide, less chance of depression. For men, especially, it can be very strong. That may be the only way that they're engaging socially is through their faith-based. So the social connection is important. Believing in something bigger than yourself can give it is a powerful sense of purpose, can help stabilize you every day, make you want to get up and give back is incredibly important. And then finally, your faith is important for helping reinforce the things that are really healthy. Oh, many faith-based organizations, practices, beliefs focus on the things that are really healthy for you, right? So in terms of maybe diet related, as is the case that we used with the Seventh Day Adventist, it may be about taking care of one another, looking out for one another. That can be a powerful well-being tool. It could be something as simple as prayer, which prayer and meditation are very powerful tools for de-stressing, managing worry, concern. Those can be powerfully reinforced through that social connection. So that's why we celebrate faith-based. And it was also what all of the original Blue Zones did. They had that as a common element. They all, except for one centenarian, had a very strong sense of faith and connection to a higher power. And so the science is what the science is.
There's so many aspects of American culture which are at odds with our health. One of the things I would mention is the mobility. I've got a job here. I can jump to this state. This corporation has an opening for me down in Alabama, and then I'm going to hop over to Washington State, and then, which, of course, uproots friendships and family, makes it more difficult to connect that way. Are those the kind of things that you help communities look at for themselves?
In terms of how they're working and where their employees are going and how stretched they feel, is that what your question is?
Well, yeah, I figure has to play into this community as connection aspect. How do you end up leveraging that? How do you change that? How do you help? And again, you're helping communities do it. You're not doing it externally.
Yeah, we connect with a lot of work sites. Unfortunately, this kind of hybrid work travel culture is probably not going to slow down anytime soon. But what we do is work with work sites to help them and employers to help mitigate the stress that their employees are feeling. So how do we help lessen the burden on the employee and help them and help the employer offer ways in which the employee has a balance in their life, can lean into well-being and have permission? We call it leading with well-being, where we are really working with frontline leaders to demonstrate, walk the walk, talk the talk, to demonstrate how well-being can be done no matter where you work. And so how does your company show up for you? What are the types of benefits? What are the types of permissions people have to lean into well-being? It could be something as simple as not traveling on Sunday. So if you do work down in Alabama, you're not going to travel and be away from your family on Sunday. The work has to happen on that Monday through Friday. That can be a powerful tool in reducing stress for people who travel a lot. For people who are in a manufacturing line dealing with widgets all day, how do you help them walk away from the line, get 10-15 minute break, downshift, and then bring to them healthy food in the cafeteria, healthier options? How do we help connect them with on-site care through providers so that they don't miss those well-being appointments, so that we're making sure that we're looking out for them in that way as well? There's all kinds of ways that we can help shape an environment for an employer, both remote and on-site, that can help actually the employee lean in and be healthier overall in that environment.
I know, Margaret, that we have to go on to some other things now. But before I leave you, I would like to hear one more time. I heard about you personally, what has motivated you in this direction. And you said that the organization, Blue Zones, as a whole, is very mission-driven. It's not just making a dollar. What is the mission? And I'm really wondering about the spirit of the organization.
What we say here and what we live every day is that the purpose, we intentionally call it purpose. It's not just a mention, the purpose of the organization. And I would say everyone that comes to this work every day in our organization is to help make the healthy choice the easy choice everywhere for everyone every day. That truly is. The full way that we say that is we say that we are focusing on to empower everyone everywhere to live longer, better. That's our stated purpose and mission. And I would say that everyone that comes to this work brings a little different strength. I would say if you met some of my colleagues, they're very focused on that connectivity piece, that faith-based component. That is what really lights their fire and makes them inspired to come to work every day. For others, they may be like myself, that they have seen up close and personal through their own experiences, the burden of chronic disease and realizing the way the role and environment plays in that, and really on fire, passion, purpose filled on changing that for as many people as we can. There are others that come at this as a healthcare component, realizing that healthcare providers are burned out, overworked, overstressed, and they want a different way to interact with their patients that actually helps them for the long term. But literally, that's just three of the things that are probably driving any one of my colleagues at any time. I would say we all come from different backgrounds, different experiences, but I would say that common purpose that I shared to empower everyone everywhere to live longer, better is very much a shared purpose.
There's much more I'd love to talk to you about, Margaret. But folks, we have been speaking with Margaret Brown, Vice President, Business Development for Blue Zones Project, their website, bluezones.com. Please check them out, and hopefully your area will benefit from their helping hand to help us all live better longer. Really, I appreciate so much your presentation here last week that I saw. The folks that I've met are inspirational and makes me really hope that our communities can be just that much better. Thank you so much, Margaret.
Thank you so much for having me. I've enjoyed our hour together.
And I hope you all join us next week for Spirit in Action. The theme music for this program is Turning of the World, performed by Sarah Thompson. Check out all things Spirit in Action on northernspiritradio.org. Guests, links, stations, and a place for your feedback, suggestions, and support. Thanks for listening. I'm Mark Helpsmeet, and I hope you find deep roots to support you to grow steadily toward the light. This is Spirit in Action.
With every voice, with every song, we will move this world along, and our lives will feel the echo.